Blog Talk Radio. What up, what up, what up? November 27, 2018, 8 o'clock, it will. 8 o'clock on the East Coast. This is a live 90-minute presentation of the Ant Canary Experience. I'm your host, Ant Canary. Welcome to the show. If you want to call in tonight, call in number 563-999-3682. 563-999-3682. Or you can just sit back and listen to the show. Call in, listen, whichever one you want to do is fine with me. I think we got a good show tonight lined up for you. We're going to jump in just a second, but let me just give a few observations from this past week. I think I gained about 10, 15, 20 pounds last couple of days eating all this food. In case you didn't know, sweet potato pie is better than pumpkin pie. Turkey will put you to sleep. I had some decent football games this past week. We also had something going on in Alabama where another innocent man, black man, was shot and killed for something that he had nothing to do with. Actually, he was trying to be a good guy, and he was shot. Come to find out, the cops had us believing that they shot. You've probably already heard the story. The cops had us believing that they shot the bad guy. Come to find out, they shot an innocent guy, and the bad guy's still on the loose, which I figured out, come to conclusion, I figured out that when they say good guys with guns, you're a good guy with a gun as long as you're white. If you're a black guy and a good guy with a gun, hang it up, because those things don't, they can't counter, they can't exist with each other. So if you're a black guy with a gun in an open permit state trying to help out, and the cops see you, they shoot first, ask questions later. This is why we take a knee. Matter of fact, I just got off, before I got hooked up and did this, matter of fact, in Cary, North Carolina, according to the story, I was trying to read to make sure I understood correctly. A family was having Thanksgiving dinner. Two sons got into an argument about players taking a knee. One of the sons became irate. He wouldn't leave the house. His father got a gun, I guess, to try to break up the fight or whatever. The gun accidentally went off. He shot his son. And these two guys were arguing over players taking a knee or not. This is why we take a knee. Not because of getting shot by your father by accident, but because institutional racism and police brutality. The cop shot the wrong guy. Nowadays, they don't try to figure out what's going on. They just start blasting when they come up, on the scene, and then they ask questions later. It's banged up. And also, let me say this before we get into the subject tonight. There were some memes going around talking about Black Friday, and some of the memes were saying that Black Friday was named because of slave auctions back in the day. That may not be necessarily the truth. Truth of the matter is that most of these companies, they want to make profit. They want to make a profit because this is the end of the year. This is the use for most retailers. This is the biggest time of the year for them, so they want to make profit. That's where the phrase comes in the black means, because when you're in the black, that means you're good. You're making money. You're not negative. When you're in the red, meaning that you're not doing so good. So whenever they say Black Friday, what they want to do is make sure that they make money at this, at the end of this holiday season. And according to what I've seen, they probably do pretty good. There's no way in the world I'm getting caught up in that nonsense. I'm not fighting somebody over a damn TV made in China. I'm not fighting somebody over some toys that, I've been through this. Been through it. Been there, done that. These kids want all these toys. You go out there beating people up trying to find them, and then when you find them and give them to them, what do the kids usually do to them? Play with them for a few days, throw them up under the bed, throw them in a closet, break them, whatever. So you go through all that trouble now, nah, you will never see me on Black Friday fighting somebody over some phone or TV or some nonsense. It ain't going to happen. I would recommend that, and I'm going to do this for the youngsters in the family, they're getting books. No toys. Now, the little kids will get toys. I've got grandkids. They'll get toys. My granddaughter probably get an educational toy. My little man, he's a little bit too young to understand, so I hadn't decided on what to get him just yet. But I've got nieces and nephews. They're going to get books. Their mom and daddy can buy them toys. I'm going to give them books. So if you need an idea for, get them books. We've got a bunch of stores around here, used bookstores. We had one store that's selling all kinds of books for a dollar. You don't have to go into debt buying gifts. And by the way, this holiday, the one of Christmas, it is pagan. Wait until next month. I'll give you a show on that. A lot of pagan practices goes along with this. So there's no need to go into debt for this stuff. Books. Never can go wrong with a book. That's my 2 cents. 563-999-3682. 563-999-3682. And I'm going to set up tonight's show. Tonight's show is entitled, Did the U.S. Government Destroy the Black Family? The black family has not been totally destroyed yet. Hopefully it won't be. But I got the idea for tonight's show by listening to an interview that Dr. Umar Johnson gave on the radio program, The Breakfast Club. And I'm not sure what the date of that interview was, but I saw it. And I listened to it. It's only a 4-minute clip. And I listened to it. I'm like, damn, he's right. He made some very good points about what's going on with the black family in America. And he touched on a few points, and we're going to talk about some of those tonight. Now, all of these points are, they're not everything, but they're pretty important. One of them that we're going to talk about. We're going to be talking about welfare. We're going to be talking about the 3 strikes and you're outlaw to the urban neighborhoods, in case you didn't already know that. You should have already known that because I've done programs on it. And also going to do, and I've talked about this before too, a practice called redlining, which pretty much kept African-Americans out of decent communities, and a lot of them had no choice but to live in substandard communities. So what does all this mean? How does all of these things play into the so-called destruction of the black family? Well, they all play a role. The black family is not destroyed altogether, but these things have contribute to some of the issues that we have in the black family. So we're going to talk about those in just a second. But before I do, I want to play that clip. Matter of fact, I put that clip on the Aunt Canary Experience Facebook page. And so I've got that clip. I'm going to play it in just a second. That's going to give us background on what we're going to be talking about. And then we're going to hear clips on, like I said, welfare, 3 strikes, you're outlaw, crack, and redlining. Now, I'm not saying that the black family is completely destroyed, but in some of these examples I give, they have contributed to some black families being destroyed. And there's probably lots of others. There was one point that he made, and I couldn't find the clip on it. He said that some of the programs that the schools used to have, as far as jobs and stuff like that goes, that contributes. And as a matter of fact, we've got GM shutting down plants all over the country, and pretty banged up that they made this announcement right around Christmas time, right around the holidays. So now you're gonna have all kinds of people, you know, that's gonna cause some issues in some families. You know, you've got a pretty decent job, and all of a sudden, you may lose it. And usually, financial issues are, you know, if you had to make a list of people breaking up and families, you know, getting torn apart, finances is usually at the top of the list. If not number one, is up there. If not number one, is number two. It's up there. So we got this going on in the country. So we'll see how that plays out. Play this clip for you in just a second. If you want to jump in on this conversation, 563-999-3682. 563-999-3682. And then when I get to the clip about warfare, I was listening to it, and it's a pretty interesting clip. It's not an older clip, but there's a lady in it, and she's you know, older lady, and she's telling stuff about what used to happen back in the day. You know, and let me point this out too. Not everybody that's black is on welfare. Black people make up 13% of the population in this country. And some people would try to have you believe that everybody black is on welfare, and that's not the case. There are more white people on welfare than black people. Matter of fact, you know, welfare was made for white people. But there are black people on welfare. There are white people on welfare. I mean, there's all kinds of people on welfare. And the story that you hear in that clip, you know, I was listening to it. I was like, man, it just blew my mind. But I'm not going to give any of that away because I want you to listen to what they had to say in the clip. 563-999-3682. If you want to call in, if you want to sit back and listen, feel free to do so. I'll be here until about 9:30. And as always, I hope you get something from this conversation. The next couple of weeks, I'm working on end of the year shows. I probably won't have a show Christmas night because it falls on a Tuesday. New Year's night, which also falls on a Tuesday. I haven't decided on that show yet, but we are going to, in a few weeks, we're going to be talking about, going to do the show on Christmas, third annual show on Christmas. And we're going to be doing another show on slavery. Give some more information about that because Brother Maurice, had asked an interesting question, and I've been working on that for a while. I just want to make sure I get everything right, so we're going to be doing that in the next couple of weeks. And it ties in a little bit to what we were talking about last week at the end of last week's show. So trying to tie everything up together. So we'll be doing that probably in the next, if not next week, probably the week after next. But I'll have to look at the calendar and see, and I will announce it on the Facebook page. So let's get into this clip. And this is Dr. Umar Johnson. And actually, the name of this clip is "The Strategic Destabilization." I can't even talk. That's wonderful. I got a talk show and I can't talk. "The Strategic Destabilization of Our Family Structure," and he gives a lot of good points to make you think. That's why when I listened to it, I had to sit down and think about it because he's exactly right. Let's sit back, listen to this. We're gonna do a little bit of talking, and I'm gonna play the clips for you. And then we'll keep this rolling until about 9:30. So here we go. Clip number one.
For the black family, do you know that we were still getting married through slavery, jumping a broom in secret, even under punishment of death? We were married during Reconstruction. We were married during civil rights. When do you begin to see the rise of the single-parented black female household? 1970. After they killed Dr. King, the United States government said we must neutralize the black power base. And they determined that the black power base was the black family. It was independent black skilled men and women who financed King, financed Mr. Garvey, financed Mr. Muhammad, financed SNCC and CORE, the Freedom Riders and the Sit-In Movement. So they said, if we want to crush the black struggle, we got to crush the black family. So guess what they did in 1970? King dies in 68. In 1970, they came into the black communities and deindustrialized our city centers. In 1970, they started shutting down the factories. Remember, up until the 50s and 60s, you didn't need a college degree to get a decent job. Many of us got grandparents who worked in factories their whole life and lived better lives than we're living now with 2 and 3 degrees. They could work in their same neighborhood, and everybody worked for the factory. Good retirement, pension, benefits, medical. They started shutting down the factories in 1970, and then they went into the high schools and did what? Started deindustrializing the inner city high schools. Up until 1970, you could graduate from almost any school in New York certified as a plumber, certified as an electrician, certified as a carpenter, auto body, brick mason, a welder. They took all those programs out. These are the skills that pays the bills, gentlemen. As long as you have a skill, you can always feed your family. But if all you got is college degrees, you might end up in the unemployment line. Why? Because the skills that we learn in college are not necessarily marketable to other black people. I'm a psychologist. Ain't too many black people running around looking for a psychologist to reveal all the skeletons in their closet.
Yeah, you better talk to a white
person. Exactly. So they started sending us to college instead of teaching us how to work with our hands. That was the 70s. That was the economic castration of the black male. Now let's go to 1980. The CIA comes in, cocaine import agency. They drop off crack. So now the unemployed black man, who has always been a breadwinner, Envy, even in slavery, we were always the breadwinner up until 1970. Now the crack comes. You got a decision. I can sell this crack and try to put some food on the table, or I can smoke it to deal with the fact that I'm no longer economically relevant to the black woman. And
trauma.
Let's be clear. The decade of the 70s was the decade of making the black man economically irrelevant to the black woman. We're the only man in America who is out-earned and out-educated by our mates. No other woman in America out-earns and out-educates their mates. And this is not the black woman's problem. I want to be clear. This was systematically done to make us irrelevant to our families. Then the 1990s come, Bill Clinton crime bill.
Mm-hmm.
Three strikes and you out.
Mm-hmm.
Mandatory minimum wages, the Bill Clinton crime bill. Now all those unemployed black men who got caught smoking crack or selling crack now being sent off to jail. And then they also give us the ADHD so that we could dope the kids up with the same medicine that sent the father to jail. Then the year 2000 come, George Bush hits us with the what? Faith-based initiative. He finds a loophole in federal law that allows you to finance churches. So now the mega churches and the medium-sized churches in the black community, Charlemagne, are being financed by the government. You think it's a coincidence, Andy, that you don't see no major churches involved in the miseducation movement? No major churches involved in the mass incarceration movement?
Black
no
black
major
black
churches black. Involved in police genocide?
Yeah.
No major churches involved in poverty? Where is the black church in 2017 when it comes to black people issues? They're missing in action because they're being paid by the government to stay out of the struggle. And that's why it's called faith-based initiative. Your pastor is the new FBI agent.
Wow. Wait, where are you?
Okay. Yeah, like I said, it was only a short clip. But that clip sets the sets up what we're going to be talking about tonight. So just wanted to play that. And we've got a caller on the line, so I'm going to grab the caller. Hopefully I can grab it. Hello, caller. Welcome to the show.
Hey, what's going on? Yeah, just tuned
hey,
in.
What's up?
Heard a little excerpt. I thought it was played also a doctor, something like Dr. Umar. I'm just tuning in with the topic.
Mm-hmm. Yep. Yeah. I don't always agree with a lot of things that he talks about, but a lot of stuff he talks about, he knows exactly what he's talking about. So that's why when I heard this clip, it's like, yeah, I got to talk about this tonight. So that's why I played it. Oh, and what's your name?
Desmond.
Okay. All right. Yeah. Are you new to the show?
Yeah, my first time tuning in. Yeah.
Cool. I appreciate you calling in. Thank you. I need all the new callers. So yeah, I'm glad you called in. Like I said, his clip set this up. Yeah. You want to say something?
I was going to say, what's the topic of the show?
Oh, the topic. Did the U.S. government destroy the black family? And I played that clip because he set up he put some stepping stones that we can talk about tonight. And the clips I'm going to play tonight while we're talking, I'm going to play a clip on the government introducing crack into the urban neighborhood. I'm going to talk about the three strikes you're out laws, redlining, and talk about welfare. and those are topics that, you know, some people may say that have contributed to the decline in the black family. But the black family is not destroyed. But these are just, I want to say they're instruments that the government used to try to break the family, the black family up after the Civil War. Because what happened after the Civil War is when all the slaves were freed, they were, you know, they were here, but they were pretty much, you know, after everything had went down, you know, they could leave the plantation, so they were pretty much on their own. But since, you know, the government was ruled by, you know, white people, they put in law like Jim Crow laws. You know, they didn't allow black people to do a whole lot of stuff in the country. So a lot of the programs that they put into place, a lot of the laws that they put in place, were pretty much, you know, they just didn't want black people to get ahead in this country after the Civil War. So some of these programs that they put into place might have broken up a lot of black families. But like I said, a lot of black families aren't broken up. But these are just some of the things that you could say that they put into place to do that. And like I said, Dr. Johnson said, you know, he brought up some good points about some of the things that the government tried to do to make sure that would happen. Because like I said, you know, if you're old enough to remember, you know, crack, we didn't get crack into the 80s. Nobody even knew anything about that. And then all of a sudden,
right,
you get this drug into the community, and then all of a sudden, you know, you're either you're buying stuff of somebody, or either you're buying it or you're selling it, and then all of a sudden, you know, the incarceration rates went through the roof, and that was done on purpose. And I've done a show on that, you know, the high school, you know, pipeline. You know, why are we 13% of the population, but almost 50%, you know, population in prison, and there's a reason for that. You know, some of these laws
yeah,
they put in place. Yeah, they knew exactly what they were doing. You know.
Yeah, because you know, the CIA. I mean, it was like a win-win for them. Put the pump, the crack
mm-hmm.
in the black neighborhoods, because for one,
mm-hmm.
they could they can put blacks in jail. For two,
mm-hmm.
they needed to raise money for the Iran war. So if they were just genuine after the Civil War when they so-called freed slaves, if they were genuine, they would have just gave us our 40 acres of new, because we already knew how to farm. So,
That's right. We
just was left with nothing. So we were just like, well, you know what? Someone was like, let's just go back to, you know, work with mass, because we, you know, some might have went to work, but they were genuine. They could have just gave us the 40 acres and mule, and we could have just, y'all go about y'all way, we go about our way. You know, you could have just stayed
mm-hmm.
separate and could have been like the Tulsa, Oklahoma, you know, all over. But, you know, they have to thrive off of us. They, you know, that's the energy. They thrive off our energy. So, therefore, it'll never... We have to. I mean, they end up on a lot of avenues. I mean, we definitely have to. We definitely, even from the hair industry, when women, you know, a lot of ladies like to get their hair done. We buy a lot of it, but we don't own any of it. And the ones that we do own, no, I'm not saying we don't own any of it. We do own some, but Koreans won't. You know, that own the majority of it, they only will let you go so far. They, you know, they want to keep their connections, and they don't even utilize the hair, you know, but everything is just, everybody draws energy from us, but us. So
mm-hmm.
until we realize
mm-hmm.
that, we build a economic structure to where it supports us, and then that starts with the schooling. So the schools, you know, it's not by coincidence. Well, all the you know, impoverished neighborhoods has poor schooling. Not just all over the U.S. So it's not by chance. So
mm-hmm.
it's a lot going on, man. I tell you.
Yep. You're exactly right. And I'll say, like, and I've said this before, that, you know, just because I'm a guy, doesn't mean that I don't mind getting my feet done. And I get my feet done because my job requires me. Sometimes I do a lot of walking. And if your feet not right, then, you know, you're going to be miserable. And I would go to, if a bunch of sisters owned a nail salon and they did feet, I would go to them. But
right.
I mean, most of the places like that are owned by Asian people. Most of the hair
correct.
Places, and I don't have hair, but my daughter buys that crap, and I just don't understand it. But, you know, I was talking that some of the things that women do, the biggest mistake that men make is trying to understand what they do. So,
right.
so I'm going to stop trying. And my daughter, and I don't understand, I'm going to quit trying. But most of the that she buys the hair from is women. And you're exactly, they don't use it. They sell it and getting crazy paid. So if more of our
crazy.
Sisters went into that kind of work, then they would be taking the money from the Asian women and they'd be making, you know. Now, I ain't saying that, and there are some places, like, you know, a lot of places like that, you know, owned by African women, you know. So there are some here and there. But most of
right.
the places that sell that stuff are Asian women. I ain't got nothing against them. I ain't got nothing against them. But, you know, I would think that for a service that, you know, caters to black women, they use that stuff all the time. So what they know what to buy and how to buy it and all that kind of stuff, wouldn't they know how to do that? And nails,
right.
you know they know how to do the nails, so why shouldn't they,
right.
you know, have their own, you know, because if there was a place like that around here, yeah, I'd go to them. Because I'm telling you, there ain't nothing like having a woman rubbing your feet and massaging your toes. Oh, my God, I'm getting the buzz just thinking about it. But, yeah, I mean, if they would, you know, have their own thing like that.
Oh,
yeah.
Man. Oh,
yeah.
man. I mean, they are there on the little spot. Oh, man, a nice-looking woman
yeah.
in there.
Yeah.
Oh, man.
They
stink.
Oh,
man, they be
I'm
mad.
Telling you. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, and all you need is a, you know, you don't need a very big place, but I mean, if you know, a place in the mall or somewhere, you know, in a busy area, and you could get that set up, man, you'd be rolling in.
Oh,
unfortunately,
man.
You know, they shut us out of stuff like that, you know. So I would hope that, you know, somebody, you know, one day, you know, get, you know, gets around to doing that, you know, type of business. I mean, it would be good. And like I said, I would go to that. I would go to a place like that because I like to get my feet done like every couple of months. I think it's important, and not only, you know, for your feet health, but, you know, if you do a lot of walking and stuff like that, you know, it does, you know, wear and tear on your feet. And I think, you know, if you take care of your feet, then, you know, the rest of your body will be good to go. But, you know, it's just something, you know, that hopefully. You know, and I haven't been all around the country, so I don't know. But I hope there are places in the country that, you know, are owned by our sisters. You know, that would be cool. And and the point you made, matter of fact, I'm gonna play this clip. This is the clip I'm gonna play in a few minutes about the CIA. You made a point because you're old enough to remember that when the government was introducing crack into the urban neighborhoods, we had the Iran-Contra deal that Reagan.
Right.
You know, St. Ronnie Reagan, because, you know, the Republicans think that he was the greatest Republican president we ever had in this country. He could do no wrong. He was doing this stuff on the sneak tip, and they got caught, and then all of a sudden, you know, they wanted to play dumb. But the money
yeah,
that they were using to sell the drugs, they were using it to fund, you know, that the Congress and all that kind of stuff. See,
yeah.
They didn't want that to get out, but it got out. And as a matter of fact, the guy – I should have written his name down, but he's in his clip. The guy that exposed them, he was writing stories about them. He ended up, according to them, and I don't believe it, he committed suicide.
Oh,
and
well, yeah,
the story
you know how
that I found out that he had two gunshots to the head. Now, how are you going to shoot yourself in the head twice?
Right. Right.
You see? How
that's
you going to do that? Unless you took a shot and you missed.
Right.
It's fishy. It's fishy. That's why, you know, the government, I'm telling you, no, don't trust. You know, the government is here for a reason, but if you put all your trust in the government, that's not a good idea. That's not a good idea. So how are you going to kill yourself with two gunshots to the head?
Right.
And you can use
it. So it's not
suicide. You can do it.
Right. That's you gonna if you're gonna kill yourself, it's gonna shoot yourself in the head, you're gonna hold it up under your chin. Who's gonna put it behind your back? That sounds like an execution style. So come on, man.
See? There's something shady going on with this stuff. So that's gonna be the first clip I'm gonna play. And it's matter of fact, the title of this clip is called CIA Crack Conspiracy. So this gives the this is gonna give you the story about, you know, how this stuff was introduced to to our community and the effects that it had on the community. Because I guarantee there are some people out there still don't think that this, you know, that the story behind all this stuff is true. But yeah, it's true. If you're old enough to remember, you know, back in the day, I remember, you know, seeing this on TV like every day in the afternoon when they were holding the hearings and stuff on, you know. But yeah, let's go to this clip, and then I'll play it, then I'll be right back.
His story, the most controversial of the past year, because after investigating the origins of the crack epidemic, he claimed he found a link leading right to the CIA.
Men who were working for the CIA's army were responsible for bringing all that cocaine into Los Angeles that sparked the crack epidemic.
The CIA's army, Webb says, were the Contras, the anti-communist rebels fighting the government of Nicaragua back in the 1980s, an army founded and funded by the CIA. Webb wrote that some Contra supporters smuggled cocaine to America to raise money for their cause.
CIA has been bringing drugs into this country.
As then CIA Director John Deutsch discovered, it's an accusation that rings true for many, especially for some in the African American community. And Webb's story has taken on a life of its own.
And Gary, this
on the talk show circuit and the internet, some have even gone beyond Webb's charges to accuse the CIA of conspiring to target young African Americans. So many
times. Was the CIA willing to poison our cities and crack with crack cocaine?
On the basis of what you learned, do you believe that there was a conscious decision, a meeting where someone sat down and said, "We're going to poison the youth of Black America, and here's how we're going to do it"?
No, I don't.
These guys were looking to raise money, and I don't think it mattered to them where they did it. They just went where they could raise money.
Gary Webb says his stories were largely based on the testimony of a drug dealer with Contra connections who became a U.S. government witness. But 9 months after the series was published, the controversy continues. Some of the heavyweights of American journalism have examined Webb's work and found it reckless, often wrong. Just this week, Webb was pulled off the CIA story after his own executive editor admitted the articles oversimplified the origins of the crack epidemic and left out important conflicting evidence. He also wrote, "I feel that we did not have proof that top CIA officials knew." But despite the evidence to the contrary, Gary Webb insists his stories were substantially accurate. And many Americans do seem willing to believe that their own government could have been involved in drug smuggling. So was the U.S. government involved in any way? Dateline decided to take a second look. Crack use spread like wildfire in the early 1980s. And in Los Angeles, a drug dealer known as Freeway Ricky Ross was in the middle of it. Prosecutors called Ross the Walmart of crack. He made millions in the early 80s dealing to Los Angeles street gangs. Police say he was among the first to take expensive cocaine powder and cook it into low-cost, highly addictive crack, then distribute it through the gangs. Webb says Freeway Ricky helped trigger an epidemic of human misery.
It destroyed our community. All the black men are in prison, most of us.
Rick Ross is now serving a life sentence for cocaine distribution.
The women are still strung on the drugs. Kids without fathers, without mothers.
And honestly, how much responsibility do you have for that?
A lot. A lot of it was my fault. I played the game.
Police in Los Angeles say he virtually cornered the crack market thanks to a steady supply of cheap cocaine, a pipeline so good that Ross was able to introduce crack to other cities using his gang contacts and to make himself, he says, a very rich man.
On your best day, how much money did you see?
couple million, two, three maybe.
On a day?
On a good day.
How many days like that were there?
A few. Quite a few.
Rick Ross's drug supplier did have connections to the Contras. Dateline has been able to confirm that from former Contra leader Eden Pastora. And Pastora admits he received some aid from that drug supplier. But Pastora says he was not aware of any CIA drug connection. So we asked Gary Webb, where is the evidence the CIA knew of any drug dealing?
You have to define the CIA. If you're saying that people who were working with the CIA know they were doing it, yeah. Did the director of the Central Intelligence Agency know this? I don't know.
This is nonsense.
Now retired, Dewey Claridge was the CIA's man in charge of Central America in the early 80s. He insists the agency had nothing to do with any drug trafficking or with any cover-up.
Oh, don't give me the conspiracy bullshit. Come on. You're a more intelligent man than that.
Well, come on.
I mean, come on. This has never been a conspiracy in this country.
Never? Gary Webb's version of events may be wrong. But in the mid-1980s, there was a high-level White House conspiracy called Iran-Contra.
Whatever you believe, Gary Webb's stories have revived interest in an issue that's been simmering since Ronald Reagan was at the White House. Were U.S. government officials aware of drug smuggling in and around the Contra movement? And did they simply choose to ignore it? One U.S. senator says, absolutely.
There's no question in my mind there is a complicity in the flow of drugs into this country, period.
A Senate investigation led by John Kerry of Massachusetts found that individuals who provided support for the Contras were involved in drug trafficking, and that one or another agency of the U.S. government had information regarding the involvement, either while it was occurring or immediately thereafter. Incredibly, according to Senator Kerry, smugglers even used the U.S. government's own airlift operation at El Salvador's Ilopango Airport to get cocaine back across the American border. This drug enforcement agent patrolled that same airport in the mid-80s.
It was just nonstop traffic coming and going, and nobody ever inspected their planes or their cargo or whatever.
Cele Castillo told Dateline he observed rampant drug smuggling at that airport.
Well, what we had was that we had Contra pilots flying out of Ilopango smuggling drugs into the U.S., cocaine specifically.
He claims the smuggling was so open it had to be condoned by the U.S. government. Castillo says planes would arrive filled with supplies for the Contras, then leave carrying cocaine for America, bound for military airfields in Florida and Texas, offloaded out of sight of the law, then shipped to California and other points in the U.S. And there's more. Castillo says when he reported all of this to his bosses at the DEA, he was told to ignore it.
So you were told point blank?
Point blank, stay away from it. It's a covert operation being run by the White House.
In a letter to Dateline, the Drug Enforcement Administration said it has vigorously investigated, and no evidence has ever been found to substantiate Mr. Castillo's charges. As for the CIA, it's denied ever aiding or condoning drug smuggling.
Reports were reaching the highest councils of our government, in the White House and in the Justice Department. There is no question of that. I can document that.
The White House and Justice Department disputed Kerry's report at the time, but he still believes some government officials turned a blind eye towards drug dealing in the mid-1980s, after the time at the heart of Gary Webb's stories. There were no indictments or prosecutions, and ultimately those allegations of drug smuggling became just a footnote in the scandal known as Iran-Contra. According to Kerry, at the time, American officials were more afraid of the evils of communism than the ravages of crack cocaine.
I'll tell you, South Central Los Angeles and every other city in America are owed an explanation. People knew that drug trafficking was getting mixed up in the flow of weapons. People knew there were bad types involved in this operation. They didn't turn off the spigot. That's plain and simple.
The CIA is reviewing the charges made by Webb and says it will conclude its investigation by the end of the year. The House Select Committee on Intelligence says it will issue its own report and that its investigation will not be affected by the Mercury News' reevaluation of its series.
So, that's one of the many stories about
crack cocaine. And also remember this, too. I'm going to grab this next caller. Also remember this, too, that say, for example, you had a white guy with powder cocaine and a black guy with crack cocaine, the brother will get more time than the white guy with powder cocaine, even if it's the same amount of cocaine. Just for the fact that the way, you know, the way it's made. So if you got a white guy with just powder cocaine and then you got a black guy with crack, the black guy is getting more time. That's the way they came up with these drug laws. Because they knew exactly what they were doing. Because, you know, you give the black guy more time in jail or prison, they got a quota. You know, some of these jails have quotas. And, you know, they make the quota. The white guy may get probation. He may get a fine or whatever. But he's not getting the same time that the brother gets with the same amount of cocaine, even though it's in a different form. But they're not going to get the same amount of time. And that can also lead into the destruction of the black family. Okay, see. Let me hit the button. Come on. All right.
Anthony?
Hey, what's going on? Hey.
What's going on?
Hey, how you doing?
Oh, I'm doing pretty good. I have to say no on this, man.
Say no on
Gary Webb.
What part?
Gary Webb said that the shipments wasn't directed to any particular people. There was no congressional enactment that put that in motion. You just have, if it happened like they say it happened, it was some unscrupulous people that had done some things.
Oh,
that's
yeah.
where that
yeah.
went down.
Yeah.
So to say
and,
that the
and
government
many...
to say that the government caused this is not accurate. I can think of a whole lot of other things that would. Yeah, the government didn't call it. It was no direct orders from no head of the agency. Was no direct orders from the DOJ. You just had some people that were running wild. Just like if you have grocery workers at a supermarket that's heisting food and other items and putting it in the trunk of their cars.
What?
Think about it.
Hello? Oh, did you want to respond to that?
To what?
No, we got another.
Hello?
But, yeah.
Oh, can you hear me?
Yeah, I can hear you.
Oh, yeah, I mean, come on, man. I don't know how you're coming with that.
And you know the CIA. The CIA is not directly – the CIA is not funded by Congress. You know that, don't you? CIA is a shadow company, or should I say group.
Shadow group, yep.
So what was going on had to be going on by some individuals. Unless they can show a path where – and I'm not saying that it didn't happen. I don't know. Yeah, I mean, the drugs apparently got in the community some way. You had the one guy make testimony that his supplier. Well, where did his supplier get it from? So it's not done unless you can show some paperwork where orders came down and said you directly supposed to do this. Then you can't say that the government is behind it. No, I don't think so.
No,
I would say they might have had. You know, now they can come out and say that they weren't. They weren't behind it, but I got a pretty good idea that, you know, they had their hands in this somewhere, because, you know, money and government, you know, you get some unscrupulous people, you know, I'm sure somebody
well, you
probably,
got some bad people,
you know, yeah.
Like you got people that's working in a bank that be fixing the books, putting money in their accounts. That's not coming down from the president of the bank. That's some person that's doing some stealing. So the same thing would have been happening in this case too.
Well, if you just look at the history of the FBI and CIA, just look at the history. Look on all the books, not just this one case. Look at the whole history. What they done with black.
Well, those different stories. We're talking about this here. Those are different stories. We're not talking about those things that you're talking about. The FBI, they was doing that against groups that wasn't popular with all blacks anyway.
Okay, well, the CIA, the government, and the FBI, they all in cahoots as far as that. They might have their own.
No, they're not in cahoots. They're not. They are agencies. Okay. The FBI is controlled by the Department of Justice.
I get that. I'm talking about as far as being black. Now, if you want to just say separate in their own operation, yeah, but when this comes to black, all of them got their hands in it. Man, it's no
well, I don't think
that.
So. Look what they did to Al Capone now.
Al Capone?
Yeah, the FBI went after him.
Okay, well, that's...
So to say that the government is behind crack cocaine, then you have to be able to show... You know, it's not like, for instance, we can say that the government was behind the bombing of Japan. Yes, we know, because you got paperwork and you got everything else. You can say that the government was behind putting a blockade around Cuba. Yes, we know that. But to say that the government, United States government, which consists of a Congress, basically passed a law that said that we're going to bring crack cocaine in and insert it into these communities, I'll make it available for drug traders. That's not possible.
Well, that's not possible. I'm not saying that's not possible. I mean, if you run an organization and you're not paying taxes, that's what I got on Capone. Because really, if you want to get deep into America, it's not United States. It's a corporation. So if you're not paying taxes, then okay, we got to come after you.
Well, United States is a constitutional republic. But I can understand people thinking that because the way the news put it out there. Gary Webb itself said it wasn't directly toward the black community. I remember those articles. As a matter of fact, I had copies of those articles. Back
but
when
I
that stuff came
agree.
Out.
I think we can agree that somehow or another that cocaine got here on somebody's boat, and we don't own a whole lot of boats. Now,
yeah.
What was that movie that Denzel Washington played in?
You remember Denzel Washington?
American Gangster. Yeah.
That was a black man that brought the drugs into the country.
Yeah. So you think the government didn't know nothing about that, right? Come on, man. I mean, they know.
Well,
that,
I tell
they,
you what,
they had their hands in there somewhere. Yeah.
Well, you said you say the government, you may have had some unscrupulous people that turned it back. You have that all the time. You have security guards that turned it back that work for businesses. But I'm saying U.S. Congress had nothing to do that. And if they did, where can you find it in the Federal Registry? Now, did crack cocaine cause problems in community? Yes, it did. I'm not saying that didn't happen. But the people that were dealing directly had more influence in that then you can say a congressman or a senator.
You're breaking up.
That's possible too. So okay, let me and that leads us into the next clip that we're going to talk about. Your outlaw that that came around back in the 80s. Now that kind of ties into what we to this this little part of the discussion. Because, if you were a career criminal and you got caught and you did, maybe you got caught for, grand theft auto and burglary or something like that, and you pretty much, hey, you got one more time. Whatever you do and you get in trouble, 25 to life. So that's what we're going to talk about in just a second. So that, that law, even though it was, I guess some people say it had good intentions, but that law, and some of the examples, if you go back and look at some examples, going to jail over, stealing a piece of pizza, or going to, something that you might get a misdemeanor for, but if you're a career criminal, you've already got two things against you. You do something, it doesn't matter how small or how big it is, you're gonna get sent away for 25 or longer. So we're going to talk about that. So I'm going to play this clip, and then we'll be right back.
There's bodies all over. Guys are shot in the head.
In the early 1990s, TV news bombarded viewers with scenes of murder, mayhem, blood and guts. The war on crime, by then 20 years old, seemed lost.
There's terrorism here in America. We live in fear, and it's not Beirut, and it's not Mogadishu.
But the murder of a California child by a man with a 20-year criminal history was a tipping point, and a wave of anger swept the country.
How could this maggot have slid through the system this many times without somebody saying, wait a minute, pal?
New sentencing laws, called three strikes, you're out, were seen as the answer to the repeat offender menace.
When you commit a third violent crime, you will be put away and put away for good. Three strikes and you are out.
With crime near historic lows today, did the lock 'em up approach work, or did it get carried away? Despite its sunny reputation, California in the 1990s could be a dangerous place. Big cities were plagued with gang violence and drug crime. Living far from all that, in the town of Fresno, Mike Reynolds, a wedding photographer, says he and his family felt secure.
Our greatest effort was to get our kids raised, give them a sense of values. We're just about ordinary people as you're going to find.
But in 1992, their lives became anything but ordinary. Their 18-year-old daughter, Kimber, home from college for a wedding, went out one night with friends in downtown Fresno.
As she went to get into the car, two men on a stolen motorcycle came up to her and tried to take her purse away from her. One of them pulled out a .357 Magnum and put it in her ear and pulled the trigger. There was nothing I could do. I've never felt so helpless in my life. She was a sweetie.
The men who killed Kimber turned out to be so-called career criminals. Both had long records and were fresh out of prison on parole.
I'm a wedding photographer. What in the world would I know about the criminal justice system and what keeps turning these criminals back out again? At some point, somebody had to do something to keep this from happening again.
Reynolds invited a dozen people to his home to bat around ideas. Ideas that crystallized in a proposal known as Three Strikes and You're Out.
Three strikes was what this was. If you have two serious or violent priors, the third felony could indeed put you away 25 to life.
Reynolds launched a one-man crusade, but didn't get far until another crime hit the news a year later.
There is an exceptional kidnapping story in Northern California tonight in the small town of Petaluma.
With her mother asleep in a nearby room, 12-year-old Polly Klass was snatched from her home in the middle of the night. For 2 months, Americans were transfixed as the media covered the agonizing search for the girl, which ended in tragedy.
My beautiful daughter Polly is dead. America's child is dead.
Polly had been strangled and left in a field. Her killer had a violent rap sheet and had just been released from prison after serving half his sentence for a previous kidnapping.
Three strikes and you're out. Yes or no?
When this tragedy hit, all the radio stations, they just said, hey, this guy would not have been on the streets if California's three strikes law was in place.
Support for three strikes and you're out is spreading like wildfire.
Reynolds' petition drive took off, securing 800,000 signatures.
We should start with a three strikes, you're out bill.
The nation, not just California, was shocked. It was a shocking crime. And it emboldened a lot of people who had sort of given up hope of changing things.
The law passed in California by a wide margin, and by 1996, the Three Strikes wildfire had spread to 24 states and the federal government.
This was an angry era in American criminal justice.
Crime scholar Frank Zimmering says Americans were angry because despite having put a record number of people in prison, crime still seemed out of control.
what was supposed to deliver people from their crime fears, what was supposed to reduce the homicide rate, was the imprisonment cure, and it hadn't worked. So that what happened in the 1990s is the transition from lock them up to throw away the key.
This is a third strike case.
While in most states, all three strikes had to be violent or serious crimes, in California, the third strike was unique.
What made it unique was that you commit any kind of a crime, the lowliest crime, that made you eligible for the three-strike law.
Los Angeles District Attorney Gil Garcetti had originally opposed that idea, believing it would put too many low-level offenders in prison for life.
It was going to be a waste of money. We know that after the age of 35 or so, crime drops off of men like this. So we're going to keep them till 50, 60, 70, 80 years of age. And even though I spoke out strongly, we were drowned out.
3 years into the law, at this Los Angeles Kmart, Kenneth Keel was arrested for shoplifting $100 worth of items.
I had became addicted to crack cocaine at about the age of 20, 21. I figured if I committed a petty crime, the most I could get would be a few months, a couple of years in prison.
But Keel had a prior record, including robbing people at ATM machines.
I discovered that Gil Garcetti was the DA and he was pursuing third strike cases similar to mine. And that's when I realized that this is serious business. I'm an elected official and the voters told me this is what they want.
Prosecutors and judges had some discretion in deciding whether to apply the law, and Garcetti had become a vigorous enforcer. Keel was convicted and received a sentence of 25 years to life. 10 years after the law was enacted, the data was stark. Nearly half of the three strikes inmates were serving 25 to life sentences for non-violent crimes.
This law, I think, did not do what the voters intended. It completely overreached and resulted in judges having to mete out sentences that were disproportionate to the criminal conduct.
He's accused of stealing a slice of pizza from a group of children at a beach pizza parlor.
Life in prison. The media, which had fueled the public anger that led to the law, now had a field day with the most extreme cases. There was the pizza thief, the cookie thief, the bicycle thief. All received 25 to life sentences for petty crimes because of more serious crimes in their past.
The question that's being raised is this really a good idea?
The three strikes law ended up populating our prisons, which are grossly overcrowded, with petty thieves and drug addicts.
Across the country, backers of tough sentencing laws, like three strikes, credit them with a historic drop in crime. But crime researchers say the drop is also due to many other factors, including 100,000 new police on the streets.
We cannot simply prosecute or incarcerate our way to becoming a safer nation.
Today, the U.S. has the world's largest prison population at a cost of $80 billion a year, leading many liberals and conservatives to call for reform. Some studies show that lengthy prison terms have barely dented the repeat offender rate. And alternatives, like drug treatment and probation, can cost less and work better for low-level offenders.
I think it would be very healthy for the country and for the Congress to reevaluate the whole way we've dealt with prison.
Former Los Angeles DA Gil Garcetti is doing some reevaluating of his own.
The lesson learned from me is that I was the elected district attorney. I should have had the backbone to stick by what I said should be the law.
Garcetti now regrets some of the sentences his office sought against nonviolent offenders, especially mentally ill and homeless people.
Those are the kinds of people that shouldn't have been sentenced under the three-strike law. Those are the people that should have received some help.
As for Kenneth Keel, he is now out of prison and helping other former strikers transition back into society. About 3,000 inmates are eligible for release, after Californians voted in November 2012 to revise the three strikes law so only violent or serious felonies count as a third strike, weakening the law voters had passed so overwhelmingly 18 years earlier.
The worst way to enact a law is to do it in an emotional, angry response to two horrific crimes. I feel for the Mike Reynolds and the Mark Classes of the world, but at the same time, they are not the ones who should be crafting and drafting our laws.
But Mike Reynolds, who fought the change in the law, says even the original one he crusaded for didn't keep the accomplice in his daughter Kimber's murder behind bars. Douglas Walker served 4 years for that crime, but after he committed another, a judge decided not to sentence him under three strikes. He's just been released again and is back in Fresno County, where the Reynolds family still lives.
There's a high probability that I could walk into a grocery store and we could be face to face. And that could happen. And the question is, what's he going to do and what am I going to do?
Okay, well, that was a little bit of info on the three strikes you're outlaw. So my thing, you know, we have in this, earlier in the year we were talking about prison reform. So that, you know, we were going to do prison reform. That'd be something that I think they should probably go back and take a look at and fix.
Well, before you let a criminal out, I think the victim should have some input on it. Don't you?
Oh, yeah. 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 And I think a lot of states have that law already. A lot of them have that. I think they call it victim impact statements or something like that.
Absolutely.
So, yeah, yeah. Yeah.
Just like your last spot here, the victim was scared and had concerns about he may meet this person on the street again. So the victims should have input before you go letting criminals out early or before their sentence is up. You know, when a criminal is sentenced, the victims don't never think that's long enough.
Oh, yeah. 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 Life or longer, probably, for a lot of them. You know, especially a lot of these, you know, violent ones that, you know, they do something, they get out, and then they go right back and doing something all over again. Those are the ones, either they need some kind of mental health, some kind of mental issue, or those are the ones you need to, like, lock them up and don't even try to, don't even attempt to let them back out, you know, cause they get back out.
And another thing.
Right back in there again, you know.
You never would have had probably the three strikes that you out until White started getting killed by career criminals. Because blacks have always complained about this. Let me give you a case in point, right, going on today. You had a case here several weeks ago where a white male went into one of those Catholic outlet stores. He took three white women.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
You hear about that?
Yeah,
he killed one.
And
did sexual assault on the other two, I believe it was. I may be off. I know one of them got killed. Now, you just elected, this is in St. Louis County, you just elected a new prosecutor who's going to take Bob McCullough place after he was voted out. Bob McCullough was the long-term prosecutor, you know, around during the Mike Brown case. And he was defeated by Wesley Bell, a black man. Well, see, Wesley Bell made the statement that he would not pursue the death penalty for any criminals that deserved it. Now, he's got a problem. Because these white folks want this white man to be given the death penalty. You go on his website, Wesley Bell, his website, and he says on his website that he will not pursue the death penalty for anyone convicted. You got the same problem with the first black female in Wesley Bell, the first black prosecutor in St. Louis County. In St. Louis City, you got Kim Gardner. She's the first black female prosecutor. And she already got in some trouble with some stuff she brought up on the governor. But she also is being accused of letting people or getting people where they can get out of jail and become career criminals. I don't know what it is, man. It don't make any sense.
Man, I read about that. I read about that guy, what, last week? He shot the woman. He got these three women, and he was going to try to make them perform sex acts. One of them refused, and he shot her in the head. And then the other two, from what I understand, they saw this, and so they didn't want to be killed. He did his thing, and then he tried to get away, and they caught him. Yeah, I read about that.
It was a black guy.
No, it was a white man.
White guy. It was a white guy. Yep, they had his mugshot. I saw that, and I read it twice because I couldn't believe what I read the first time when I saw it. So I had to reread it because. You know, if you just read something. I forgot what the headline was, but I saw the headline and I read it. And I read it, and I'm like, wait, whoa. I just read what I thought I read, so I had to go back and look at it again. I'm like, man, if this clown don't get the death penalty, I mean, he just shot the woman in the head. He didn't care. He just blew her away. Now, you know, clowns like this don't get served justice. I mean, I don't know who... Yeah, I saw that. That is retarded. I mean, that's just yeah. If you can find that story, take a look at it. Cause it's I wonder sometimes about people, you know, sick people. I mean, that guy is sick. He's got issues. He's got some serious issues. I got two more clips to play. We got a few minutes. We got about 15 minutes left. They're not long, but this next clip, I've played this clip before. This clip is on redlining, and some people may not know what this is about. What redlining is, and the clip explains it better than I will, but I'll just give you a really quick synopsis. What redlining does, it draws circles, not circles, but it draws areas in a city where white people live, which are red line. Those are good areas. I mean, I'm sorry, green line. The red line on a map shows where minority people live. So if you got somebody wanting to buy a house, you know, now this used to happen, you know, and matter of fact, I played this very same clip when I did a story on the when our black veterans came back from World War II. How they retreated when they came back, you know, and my issue when I played the clip and my issues about that story was that, you know, we have people in this country that are so, you know, they love the military, you know, we love you, blah, 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 but they don't love everybody in the military. So when our brothers came back from World War II, instead of them getting the same programs that the white soldiers got, they got shafted. So when the white soldiers came back and they were able to get the GI Bill, when they were able to, you know, buy homes, all this kind of stuff, the black soldiers didn't get that opportunity. So you had this system called redlining where when they came back and they wanted to buy homes, they couldn't buy homes in certain parts of cities because of this practice. So this is not a long clip. But like I said, I played this clip before, but if you've never heard about this practice, I'll say this: if you've never heard about redlining, once you hear this clip, if you don't get pissed off by listening to this stuff, if you've never heard it before, if you don't get pissed off about this, then you need to get checked. But it's not long. I'll play it and I'll be right back.
We came to Levittown and we found the model house, and we walked in and we looked around and. Of course, in the eyes of a young man who was raised in the ghetto, so to speak, it was an interesting experience, interesting lifestyle, seeing all the new modern conveniences. Very fascinating.
Eugene Burnett came home with almost a million other black GIs. They had fought for the country in segregated ranks. They returned hoping for equality and the American dream. For many, that dream was a new home for little money down and some of the easiest credit terms in history.
I went up to the salesman. We're interested in your home. We're interested in buying one. And what is the procedure? Is there an application to be filled out? So forth. So he looked at me, looked around, and he said to me, he says, listen, it's not me, but the owners of this development have not as yet decided to sell these homes to Negroes.
It was as though it wasn't real. You can't imagine. But for someone to come out and actually tell you that they can't sell to you. You know, I was really on an up. Man, look at this house. Can you imagine having this? And then for them to tell me because of the color of my skin, I can't be a part of it.
The FHA underwriters warned that the presence of even one or two non-white families could undermine real estate values in the new suburbs. These government guidelines were widely adopted by private industry. Race had long played a role in local real estate practices. Starting in the 1930s, government officials institutionalized a national appraisal system where race was as much a factor in real estate assessment as the condition of the property. Using this scheme, federal investigators evaluated 239 cities across the country for financial risk.
So that those communities that were all white, suburban, and far away from minority areas, they received the highest rating, and that was the color green. Those communities that were all minority or in the process of changing, they got the lowest rating. And the color red. They were redlined. As a consequence, most of the mortgages went to suburbanizing America, and it suburbanized it racially.
The racial logic adopts the principle that an integrated neighborhood is a bad risk, is a financial risk, that an integrated neighborhood is likely to be an unstable neighborhood, unstable socially, but therefore also unstable economically.
When the white residents of 8 Mile Road in Detroit were told they were too close to a black neighborhood to qualify for a positive FHA rating, they built this 6-foot wall between themselves and their black neighbors. Once the wall went up, mortgages on the white properties were approved. Between 1934 and 1962, the federal government underwrote $120 billion in new housing. Less than 2% went to non-whites.
I can understand an individual, depending on his environment or his family or whatever, being racist, but for your country to sanction it, give him tools to do that, there's something deadly wrong there.
I included that information because, you know, some people may not have heard that practice, but it will, I think, would contribute to affecting black families because, you know, if you're a man and we're men and we have families, the first thing we want to do is take care of our family. Wife, kids, whatever. And one of the basic things you want to do is make sure that they have a comfortable house and a comfortable neighborhood so that we don't have to worry about it. So if you're out there looking for a house, you know, you want to find the nicest neighborhood, nicest schools, and all that kind of stuff. And then you get told that you can't live in a certain neighborhood because you're black, you know, I think that would, that could be some kind of factors to.
Well, that must have been a long time ago because these Africans that come here, they move out in some white areas I never would want to live in myself.
Yeah, I mean, we've got some areas, it's like, you know, you drive through them and it's like, you know, they build up houses around here so fast that now they have houses. They build, you know, condos. They have their own grocery stores. They have their own bowling alley. I seen one the other day, and I thought it was kind of weird that they have their own liquor store. Because here in North Carolina, you know, the state controls liquor sales, so you just can't walk into a convenience store and buy liquor, the hard stuff. So they've got, you know, and it's sitting right out front of their neighborhood, is ABC store. So they've got their own liquor store. You know, so they can,
then,
you know, I'm gonna go get me a bottle of scotch. They can just walk across the way and get, you know, that kind of deal. You would never, I don't think, you would never see anything like that in a black neighborhood. But, you know, I could be wrong. But, you know, it's just.
Well, yeah, out there in South Central, they sell more, the Koreans sold more liquor in South Central L.A. than the whole state of Vermont, I think. But redlining can be good because you know why? It tells you where not to buy a house, where not to send your kids to school, and so on, so on, so on.
But depending on if you want to buy a house in a neighborhood that won't, you know, look at you because of the color of your skin and decide that they don't want to sell to you, you know, that might be a problem. But, you know, but I mean, that type of thing goes on all the time. It still goes on to this day, unfortunately. I'm sorry. Go ahead.
Okay, well, 2000, I guess now it's like a remix. They got the gentrification going on. So it's like they're moving all the major cities, you know, they flip-flopping it. So.
Yeah. You know, I forgot about that. Yep, you're exactly right. And I've seen that going on downtown here in Raleigh. I've seen that, you know, places that used to be black, now, you know, they fix them up and they're you know, like townhouses. You know, white people, you know, they're slowly moving, you know, and a lot of places where you wouldn't think they would move to, now all of a sudden, you know, they're moving into them, you know, which is, you know, so yeah, you're exactly right. This last clip talks about welfare and some of the practices that they used to do back in. I don't know if they do it now or not because I'm not on welfare and I hadn't talked to anybody that, you know, to ask them, you know, are they still doing this stuff? But some of the practices in this clip, what they talk about, you know, this is a, you know, matter of fact, some of these people are, you know, they're a little bit older, so they were witnesses to a lot of the things that used to go on back in the 60s and 70s and probably, you know, 80s or something like that. But I'll play this. This is the last clip. I'll play this, and then I'll wrap this up in a nice little bowl because I haven't had dinner yet. My stomach is growling. So we'll play this and be right back.
My relationship with Pruitt-Igoe was that of a research assistant. I went to Washington University to graduate school in 1964. I was working on a National Institute of Mental Health funded study on social problems in public housing. My role was to study women and girls in Pruitt-Igoe. I was 20 years old. I'd just gotten out of college. Some of the girls were 18 years old, and I was 2 years older, but yet my life was vastly different. As time passed, I did wonder, would my life have been similar to that of the girls had my parents migrated from Mississippi to St. Louis? Would my opportunities have been different? I guess to put it bluntly, I never saw the people in Pruitt-Igoe as that different from the lives of poor people I had grown up with in Mississippi, except for one thing, the strong, tightly knit communities and families in which I grew up had begun to shatter around the people who were displaced in a northern city with few supports. And the policy and the housing authority was to move the poorest of the poor, the most dependent families, to Pruitt-Igoe.
Before we moved into Pruitt-Igoe, the welfare department came to our home. They talked with my mother about moving into the housing project, but the stipulation was that my father could not be with us. They would put us into the housing project only if he left the state. My mother and father discussed it and They decided that it was best for the 12 children for the father to leave the home. And that's how we got into the projects.
The welfare department had a rule that no able-bodied man could be in the house if a woman received aid for dependent children. If a man lost his job, he's looking for work, he still had to leave the home. And there was even a night staff of men who worked for the welfare department, whose job was to go to the homes of the welfare recipients, and they searched to find if there was a man in the home. Sometimes men came back at night to be with their families. Some were found in closets hiding.
I remember vividly my mother telling us, if white people come to the house and ask you guys questions, tell them that your father is not here. Tell them that your father has never been here. You have not seen your father. I trusted her. I knew that there was a reason that we had to do this charade. And I participated in the charade. I sat there and looked those people in the eye and told them pure earnestness that, no, I have not seen my father. And no, my daddy does not live here. And but I knew that I was lying. And that made me wonder, who are these people and how do they have the power to make my mother lie?
We're giving you money. We want to be able to control you. We're giving you money, so we have the right to make stipulations as to how you use it and what you use it for. There were so many restrictions. We couldn't have a telephone. We couldn't have a television. And we were really left at the mercy of the system.
In the project, it seemed to be strategically planned to create an environment that people felt isolated, that people felt restricted, that people felt, you know, inhuman almost. You're bad. We have to restrain you. We have to curtail what you're doing. It was void of humanity. It was void of caring. It seemed more like a prison environment that you have to escape from.
They were treated in some ways like they were prisoners. If we are going to support you and to give you a few measly dollars to live on, then we're going to extract blood from you. You're going to live according to the rules we set. And the rules just happen to be very punitive. There was this whole undertone of morality, that they had poor morality, that they were immoral by virtue of the lifestyles they lived. Poverty never created immorality. Poverty created want.
When we first moved in the projects, we couldn't have a television.
Here it is.
And then my mother got a letter that we could have TV.
Barbie's dream house is a wish come true for both of you. And look.
I was always interested in the family programs. Programs with fathers. My Little Margie, where the father was so involved with his daughter.
Margie!
Come on in, Dad.
Margie, you know I've always tried to be both mother and father to you.
You've been wonderful, Dad.
Do you remember that little game we always play when you have a problem that you can't tell your father?
But I haven't got any problems.
Now come, tell me what's wrong.
When I looked at those sitcoms, I just felt like this is the way white people live. Because black people, from my experience, did not live that way. And I never questioned, I never wondered why. I just figured this is how it is.
We have our home here, and if the colored move in and run real estate values down, it's bound to create tension. And you will have, well, I think their aim is mixed marriages and becoming equal with the whites.
Well, I just could not live beside them. I don't feel that they should be oppressed. But I moved here. One of the main reasons was because it was a white community. And that's the only place I intend to live.
So, with that last clip, that brings us to a close. So they're not close to tonight. The black family is not totally destroyed. These are some factors that may have played a part in some of the end of some families. But like I said, that's what I'm here for. That's history. So take the good with the bad. So, like I said, that's the end of tonight's show. Glad you could listen. I want to say thanks to got a new caller last week. Got another new caller this week. So people are starting to pay attention. So I'm glad for that. I appreciate it. We'll be back next week, next Tuesday, from 8 to 9:30 with another topic. Once I decide what we're going to talk about, I'll post it on the Facebook page. Whenever you get a chance, check the page out. Comment, question, whatever. I appreciate it. I'll take all the input. But I will be back next week, 8 o'clock, with another topic. And I hope to see you here. Be good. Peace out.